Some five-year-olds getting ready for a poetry class at their primary school just outside Cambridge.
Who remembers the rain poem?
But it's a poetry class with a difference. It's part of a research project exploring how five-year-old brains work. The idea is that an understanding of the underlying processes of the developing brain could turn the humble nursery rhyme into a powerful tool for boosting young children's language and reading skills. We'll be hearing more from those children later in the programme. This is one of a wealth of studies based on the latest neuroscience and the ability that we now have to see inside the brain using scanners. There's a lot we now know that we didn't know 5 years ago. So much, in fact, that there's a new field developing, neuroeducation, with the specific aim of applying this new understanding to what actually happens in schools. There's undoubtedly an appetite amongst teachers to learn more about the brains of their charges. But as we'll hear, this means teachers sorting the brain fact from the brain fiction, which has become worryingly prevalent. We only use 10% of our brains. Not true. We're either left-brained or right-brained. Not true. But when it comes to decent research from neuroscientists, head teachers like Anne Mitchell at Histon and Impington Infant School just outside Cambridge are interested in any insights which might help the young minds in their care.
I think it's essential that we understand how the brain works, because if we understand how the brain works, then we can ensure that children learn in a better way.
Teachers have a very genuine and justified interest and enthusiasm for the brain.
Paul Howard Jones, an expert in the emerging field of neuroeducation at the University of Bristol.
They are the professionals that are in charge of changing the connectivity and structure of their children's brains on a daily basis. Learning is very much about the brain, and they should be interested. I think it's wonderful that they are. But unfortunately, in the absence of any formal training in neuroscience, they have developed a whole set of concepts which not only are incorrect, but are probably influencing their approach in the classroom.
So how much do we really know about the five-year-old's brain? And can neuroscience really tell us what to do in the classroom? Professor Brian Butterworth of University College London says that the advances being made could have a profound effect on how we teach young children.
Well, I think this is a really important emerging discipline, but it's something which is in some aspects at a very early stage, but actually not such an early stage. The basic science is now really quite well advanced. We've got very good brain imaging methods now, much more sophisticated, many more areas that are relevant to the classroom, like, for example, social and emotional development, what to do with problem children, ADHD, autism, all these things are much better understood. We know more about the reading system in the brain, more about the math system in the brain. So what we need to do now is translate that basic research into something that's going to have classroom applications.
At the moment, most teacher training courses include little on the brain, but educationalists and neuroscientists are starting to work together. Cambridge University is incorporating a Centre for Neuroscience into its teacher training facility in a new venture headed by Professor Usha Goswami. She's convinced that an understanding of the neural processes in the young child's brain is not just something for neuroscientists, but for teachers.
I really am a believer that once you understand mechanisms, so you understand why a child is behaving as they are or why the intervention that you're doing with that child is or isn't working, you can then innovate. So if you understand mechanism, then you can be a teacher using your own skills and your own professional insights because you have that basic understanding.
Now, it seems to be asking a lot to expect teachers to be worrying about brain signals and neurons on top of everything else they have to contend with. But one of Usha Goswami's research students, Kate Prentice, has begun to put some of this new knowledge into practice with this class of five-year-olds at Histon and Impington Infant School in Cambridgeshire.
Brain on the green grass, brain on the tree, brain on the rooftop.
We all know children like nursery rhymes, but what she's doing is applying evidence showing that rhyme and rhythm affect the way the brain learns, to see whether this translates into improvements in reading.
Poetry naturally privileges rhythm and rhyme, and rhythm and rhyme are both, we've seen through psychological research, both really important for reading development. So here you have a kind of natural delivery mechanism, if you like, for training children on rhythm and rhyme, and it's also something that they enjoy, so you've got the kind of double benefit there.
Hand on the bridge, feel the rhythm of the train.
Hand on the bridge, feel the rhythm of the train.
Hand on the bridge, feel the rhythm of the rain.
Hand on the bridge, feel the rhythm of the rain.
Hand on your throat, feel the rhythm of your talk.
Hand on your throat, feel the rhythm of your talk.
Hand on your leg, feel the rhythm of your walk.
Hand on your leg, feel the rhythm of your walk.
Hand in the sea, feel the rhythm.
So why does rhythm help with development, do you think?
Well, you think about sound as a continuous stream of noise. Rhythm helps us work out where the words are, and then within that where the syllables are, and within that where the kind of intra-syllable units are. So rhythm and perception of rhythm is really important for children, both, you know, infants when they're working out words and language development, but also with reading. Because if you think of the process of reading as a kind of recoding of the sounds of words onto written symbols of words, it's very important that they understand the individual units so that they can do that recoding. And having a good rhythmic perception will allow you to hear those individual units more clearly. So that's one of the ways in which rhythm's important.
It holds my head, the thoughts I've had, the things I've read. It keeps off the wind, it keeps out the rain. It hugs my hair and warms my brain.
What you're doing is taking the research that's been done in neuroscience and applying it absolutely in practice to the classroom.
Absolutely, and also looking at research that's been done within cognitive psychology more generally. So, for example, the other element of my research, which looks at rhyme, is all to do with how something called phonological awareness is important for reading development. And phonological awareness is awareness of the sound structures of words. So you can break words down into syllables, and you can break syllables down into smaller units, and so on, into as far down as phonemes, which are the kind of indivisible units of sound. So children that have particularly good phonological awareness will also be probably quite good readers, and they've shown there's a relationship between individual differences in phonological awareness and individual differences in reading ability.
And aren't nursery rhymes something that they're still doing in schools anyway? You know, do you need to do the research to show that extra needs to be done? Aren't they doing that already?
This is a really good question, and I think if you talk to teachers, they will say, we think that rhyme does something really important. And a lot of people, you know, not just teachers, that it's been written about a lot in the media, there have been lots of kind of articles written about it. Poetry is good, poetry is a good thing. And if you go into the playground, like I said, you'll hear it. But in fact, if you look at the curriculum and you look at what actually happens in classrooms, there's no memorising at all, for a start, apart unless an individual teacher chooses to do it in the classroom, but it's certainly not on the curriculum. And a lot of the lessons to do with poetry focus on individual elements. So there might be a lesson on rhyme, but I'm suggesting that actually the global poem, the poem as a whole, is important. And I think memorising is particularly important because memorising allows the children to kind of take on those sound structures themselves and hold on to them. And memorising, of course, is something we used to do in classrooms many decades ago and have stopped doing. And it seems that it's something children really enjoy. And so I'm sort of asking the question, why don't we do it? And if we were to do it, what would be the effect?
And research from Brain Science can throw up some surprises too. Which of us didn't love getting that treasured prize of primary school, a gold star? Well, it turns out that reward consistency, as scientists like Paul Howard Jones like to call it, isn't always a good thing.
Well, essentially, we assume in education that reward consistency is what underpins motivation. So if you have the right answer, you should get a point. However, what we're beginning to learn from neuroscience is that uncertain reward is a lot more motivating than certain reward.
What, so you only give them a gold star sometimes?
It is a little bit like that.
It's a bit rough.
It is a little bit counterintuitive because obviously you start thinking, well, you know, if you're not sure whether you're going to get the point or not,
why try?
And yet this is the basic principle of games, and this is why we think games engage their players so much. And in fact, humans do have an attraction to 50-50 odds in games.
So we like the fact there's an element of chance in games, and it's
absolutely
partly skill, but it's partly throwing the die.
We get drawn towards 50-50 odds. You know, if it's 90%, it's too easy. We know we're probably going to do it. If it's 10%, it's just not rewarding enough. And 50% seems to be a bit of a magic number. Now, what happens in schools is that as soon as we're in an environment where we're being assessed, then immediately we prefer to be 90% certain, around 90%, that we're actually going to get it correct. That's where our comfort zone is. However, the problem with that is that it doesn't engage those highly motivating signals, those dopaminergic responses in the brain's reward system. And essentially, you know, at that exciting level of engagement, we're not really there anymore because we're working with 90% certain odds. The way around this, of course, is to introduce gaming into learning. So you're combining learning and games of chance at the same time. And we've found this to be immensely effective in terms of motivating learners, and especially boys, which from the neuroscience is probably what you would expect.
Both Paul's work with Holding Gold Stars and Kate's on Rhyme and Rhythm are at the experimental stage at the moment, although the results seem promising so far. But one area which is already reaping the benefits of our improved knowledge of the brain is that of maths, and in particular with children who find numbers very difficult. Brian Butterworth.
Well, one of the things that we know about is that there are particular brain areas that are responsible for numerical processing, that in some children, and indeed in some adults, these brain areas seem to have developed abnormally. This goes along with a very severe difficulty in learning arithmetic. It's not about maths in general, because other areas of maths might be all right, but arithmetic and number skills, they're particularly affected. So there seems to be a very specific kind of difficulty that some children, maybe 5%, have in learning arithmetic. Now, that's what neuroscience has told us. It's been very well established in several different countries. It doesn't, of course, tell us what to do about it.
No, and also teachers would probably say to you, well, we know that. We know that there's some children who can't do it. We have them in every class.
Indeed, but there are different reasons for not being able to do it. So lots of reasons for being bad at maths. My own personal excuse is I didn't have a very good maths teacher. However, this particular difficulty, which in many cases, perhaps all, persists into adulthood, means that these kids are going to have great difficulty learning arithmetic. And if you give them standardised interventions that you give to other kids who have problems learning, they're not going to learn very quickly. So what these children need, and these children are called dyscalculics, what they need is specialised intervention. And there are some teachers who know about this, but not that many.
Is there an argument for teaching teachers more about neuroscience and developmental psychology when they do their teacher training in the first place?
I would say there is. Now, there isn't very much neuroscience in any PGC curriculum at the moment, so I think we're trying to change that.
It's clear that developments in neuroscience could have profound effects on children with learning difficulties, but Usha Goswami thinks this is just the start.
I think the long-term promise of educational neuroscience is that we could have biological markers for learning difficulties like autism or for dyslexia, and we would know very early on who was more at risk than another baby, and then enrich the environment in ways that we know might work and make a difference to the whole developmental trajectory.
That sounds extraordinary, that you could take a baby and predict whether they're likely to develop dyslexia or not.
It would be extraordinary in that sense, and we're certainly nowhere near there yet. But the amazing thing about neuroscience is how quickly the innovations in technology are coming. And it's quite remarkable, actually. It's also to do with engineering and modelling and signal processing, so trying to understand what these very simple brain cells might be doing when they represent the complex information that's our conversation or that's the visual world.
So can you do things now that you couldn't do 5 years ago?
Oh, very definitely. It's actually remarkable how quickly the field is moving.
And if you could work out which babies might be going to have difficulties when they get to school, I'm wondering how that would go down in a way with parents, and is there a danger that you'd be labelling a child very early on, and long before they're even at school you'd be worrying about that sort of thing?
I do think there are ethical issues, and I think it's very important that neuroscientists don't overstate their findings, because often when brain science is thought to have gone into the classroom, it's based on a very sketchy set of links that have been made often by a commercial company. So it's very important to do the work well and then not to overinterpret it. So all the things we've discussed in the last couple of minutes, they're not things we can do tomorrow. They're things that we may have in the next decade or even in the next 20 years.
The science moves fast, of course, but are there lessons that today's teachers can already learn from the latest scientific insights? Mike Askew, Professor of Maths Education at King's College London, is cautious.
It feels to me like we're still in the foothills of knowing what we're going to scale with this, because there's still debate even within the neuroscience community about how the brain works. So you have some people who are still committed to the idea that the brain is quite modular in the way it works and that particular parts of it are needed for, say, mathematics, and others who are much more wedded to the idea now of it being distributed across the whole brain. So from my own perspective, it's not so much that we're resistant to learning from the brain research, but until we've actually reached a point where there's a bit more consensus about what the implications are, I'm not sure I want to start making recommendations to teachers.
And although teachers are clearly extremely interested in anything brain-based that might help them and their students, it's this absence of concrete applications which has led to a worrying trend, according to Paul Howard Jones.
In the absence of any sort of scientific authority in these areas, the translation has taken place anyway. And so we've ended up with a lot of quite strange ideas. And in a way, that's almost providing a barrier now for some of the more authentic neuroscience to enter educational thinking, because there's quite a lot of stuff that needs to be undone.
Anything purporting to be about the brain has always been fantastically popular with the general public, and teachers are no different, hence the number of neuromyths which have taken hold. Research doesn't back up the claim that some of us only use the right side of our brains and some the left, and it's definitely not true that we only use 10% of our brains. If we did, we couldn't function. But some brain-based pseudoscience has filtered into our education system, through no fault of teachers.
There's quite a wide variety of different neuromyths, we call them, deriving from a number of different sources. Some of them are quite technical in a sort of pseudo-sense, in terms of, I mean, one of them, for example, is this idea that exercise can somehow help reintegrate right and left hemisphere and improve your literacy. And that's quite a technical idea that comes with a lot of pseudoscientific concepts behind it. And then there are other ideas, such as if you don't drink 6 to 8 glasses of water a day, then your brain will shrink. That's come more from sort of popular arena, I suppose, you know, the popularity of drinking water and water company advertising and all sorts of more sort of common myths, urban myths that have entered the general public and then ended up in school where it's being related to learning.
And are those both just completely wrong, those two ideas you've just given?
There was some sort of idea that coordination exercises could help rewire the brain in individuals where there had been some difficulty in the developmental trajectory. But there is no reasonable scientific evidence to support that. And I think the one about the water is quite interesting, because it's almost a neurosis sometimes about drinking water, that you have to drink enough water, you have to keep hydrated. Now, this is a bit more complicated, and I think there's a lot of neuromyths where you have to look at them quite carefully, because there's quite often some sort of grain of truth. Now, you only have to be dehydrated a very small amount in order for it to affect your thinking. But it is also true that you only have to be overhydrated a certain amount as well for it also to affect your cognition. And that was research that was done at Bristol University. So they asked adults who were not thirsty to drink water, then they tested their thinking and found that, in fact, it was less than before. And the other issue is that actually the idea that children voluntarily dehydrate themselves in normal circumstances is a little bit faulty. I mean, normal, healthy children tend to become thirsty and then they want to drink. I mean, I think that's the important thing, is that children should be free and able to drink when thirsty.
Teachers can't be expected to have the time or the specialist skills needed to read and critique neuroscience papers. But I was wondering what they make of these myths about drinking water, for instance. Primary school teacher Margaret Dunlop.
That makes sense. I mean, it actually makes sense. So that's what you would expect, wouldn't you? Because when you look at previous generations, they've been perfectly capable of learning without drinking pints of water and all this. But at the same time, when you hear about it from whatever source, it does gain a bit of credence, and you might might put more emphasis on it than that would be healthy. So we do need to know. I think it's vital that we are given that information.
Another very popular idea in schools that many parents will have heard of is learning styles. Usha Goswami.
Well, this is the idea that some children are visual learners, so they learn best through visual materials. Other children are kinesthetic learners, so they learn best through manipulating things. And other children might be auditory learners, so they learn best through language-based instruction. Whereas, in fact, of course, all those systems in the brain will be active all the time, whichever kind of learning you think you're using.
So we're constantly taking in information in all these senses and putting it together?
Well, because the brain is a multiply interacting system. You can't ever isolate one component. So, again, that's a kind of neuromyth, that because we can find that, say, visual processing mainly goes on in the back of the brain, auditory processing is more at the sides of the brain where your ears are, that doesn't mean that those are the only systems active when you're listening or when you're looking, because you then need to interpret what you're looking at or listening to, and so many other systems will immediately be in play.
Couldn't you still have a preference for one of those systems, though, in the sense that, you know, in the same way that we know that some people are better at remembering their notes if they've got them all written down than if they've drawn diagrams when they're trying to revise, others might like repeating it again and again to themselves?
But then the scientific question becomes, is that a preference or is it something dictated by the makeup of your particular brain? And I guess I'm saying that it is not dictated by the makeup of your particular brain.
There's a common sense sort of feeling to this.
Paul Howard Jones.
We all have individual preferences, so it's not very unlikely that if we distributed a questionnaire now, you would have a different learning style to me. Unfortunately, what has not been shown, and there have been many, many studies to try to show it, that there is any educational advantage to having your learning style identified and being taught in that learning style.
That seems quite surprising. If we think there are preferences, it seems surprising there isn't an educational advantage in it.
Well, there are various reasons why not. I mean, first of all, in terms of the brain is very interconnected. The second thing is that actually if you are better at processing in one modality, there might be something to be said for getting more practice in the other modalities. But also, when something becomes more difficult, you actually remember it more. So there are psychological reasons as well as to why that might not be the case. And in fact, a psychological study that was undertaken showed that indeed it was true that some learners benefited more from having information in a learning style that they had not been identified as possessing. So I think there's all sorts of problems with it. And yet it's very, very popular, and an awful lot of time and money and inset time in service training in schools has been devoted to differentiating learners on the basis of learning style. And in extreme examples, we've had children walking down the corridor with a V label or an A label stuck on them.
So how come this information has taken hold and been applied in so many schools?
Teachers are not a distinct breed from the rest of the population. So there are so many websites out there about the left and the right brain. There's so much in the popular media about learning styles and being visual, auditory or kinesthetic. You have these popular quiz programs about are men's brains different from women's brains and so on and so forth. So teachers, like anybody else, are going to be caught up in that media talk about it. But the other thing is that teaching is such a difficult profession. And when you've got 25 children, to actually meet the needs of all of them is really quite hard. Teachers are not given a good press at the moment. They still are kind of being held accountable for children not doing well. So if somebody comes along being quite authoritative and saying, well, I can give you the reason, and it's based in brain research, as to why Claudia might be not doing so well in maths, then it's quite tempting to think, well, yeah, there's something I can latch onto which might account for why particular children are having difficulties, which is an easier message sometimes to pick up than to say, well, I need to look at the sort of experiences that these children have had and whether I need to compensate for those difficulties that they're having, rather than just accept that there's a problem there that I'm powerless to do anything about.
But now we know there is some good research. Why doesn't that get through to schools instead of this misinformation?
I suspect that's because of the time lag of how research moves from the academic world into the popular world. So, you know, neuroscientists, they're quite measured in the claims that they're making, that they're not making these grandiose claims, that they've yet got the answer, that they've got some really interesting questions which have challenged some of these myths and assumptions that they already have. But until they start to come up with something that can replace those myths, nobody really is going to buy into a training which says, I'm going to come and tell you what doesn't work. They want to be told what does work. And so until that noise is out there, then people, I think, will carry on buying into them.
And if I were to set myself up as a business, going into schools and saying to them, I can teach you what the neuromyths are, and I can teach you all the things that you might be doing wrong, the things you might be thinking wrongly about the brain, presumably no one would be very interested in that.
Well, no, because teachers, as I was saying, teachers in the press are being told all the time they're getting it wrong. So
they're not going to pay me to go and tell them that.
Afraid not. No, you're not going to make your fortune doing that.
Come on then, what are you going to say to draw the sign?
But it turns out that teachers are more discriminating than it might sound. They look at the information they're given and then pick and choose the bits that they think might work in their classroom. And after all, they're the ones who should know. At Hampton Gurney Primary School in London, I asked three teachers, Sunita Malervi, Regan Prinsloo and Anna Chapman, how they judge what's good and what's not.
You give it a go, don't you? And from that you learn whether it works or if part of it works, if you need to tweak it. There's so much thrown at you, but you do, you filter out a lot of it, but you go for some things and then some of them work and some of them don't.
I think you really have to be open-minded as a teacher, try at least explore some of the things coming in and then see if it works for the children, if it doesn't. There's so many little places where you can learn from, and every time you come back from that, you feel enriched again and think, I actually should have tried that. I think as a teacher, you should just be open-minded for all the new things coming in and try it out as well before you just filter it out and say, that's not going to work for my class, or I don't feel comfortable with this or that.
teaching is constantly growing and constantly changing. And so if you hear of a new terminology or a new study that's been, and there's courses run, then obviously the school will send you on those. And if they're applicable to your age group, you try and trial and error. So if it works for your group or if it works for a particular child in your class, you go with it. If it doesn't, you take what you know and you can see how you can adapt it to the children in terms of their learning.
So you're taking it in terms of, you're taking what you learn and always applying it in terms of what you already know and what might work in your classroom. You're not just taking things wholesale necessarily.
No, I think you've got to be careful that to realise maybe it won't work. And in our situation, it does seem to work, but they need to be exposed to other ways because it's not like this throughout their school year. Their school years to follow. They've got to be exposed to different styles of learning. And again, you're going to be exposed to different teachers, you know, so and how they put their points across.
Or is it down to those who really know the science to let teachers know what is and isn't backed up with evidence? Margaret Dunlop.
It's not really our responsibility. I think whoever's doing the research, surely if they'd want to disseminate this information if it's going to be of value. Because the main thing is we want to enhance children's learning in any way that we can, because that's the nature of what we do, their ability to learn. And anything is really useful, but we're not going to be in the position to make the judgments as to whether it's going to be effective or not effective, whether it's valid or not or invalid. We need to be supported in that, and I suppose that's going to be the next challenge, isn't it? How is all this information disseminated and then used? How is it going to be used?
At Bristol University, they're creating a website where teachers can check out the brain-based systems they're offered to see what the evidence is. And the Institute of Education is also planning ways to disseminate good information to teachers without bombarding them. So will we see a day where good neuroscience really does get into the classroom and make a difference to the children, which is, after all, what this is all about? Mike Askew.
I hope so, and I think one of the things that it will continue to do is to challenge our beliefs about learning. So I think, you know, the evidence now that the idea that there maybe were critical periods that you had to catch children at, I know that works for things like being able to pronounce a foreign language, but basically the research seems to be saying that right up into your dotage, the brain continues to be malleable and can change. So if the messages are, you know, we can't give up on kids too soon, then I think that's a really powerful and important one. And I strongly hope that the research will continue to show that those are the sorts of things we need to be doing.
Inside the Brain of a 5-Year-Old was presented by Claudia Hammond. The producer was Alexandra Feacham. And for details of the websites that were mentioned in that programme, you can visit the Radio 4 webpage.